Income inequality has become a big issue in America, and has become a big issue again, we should say. We're quite mindful lately of the huge gap between the top earners and the people at the bottom, partly because we're not supposed to be a society separated by class divisions. We're supposed to be able to work our way up, no matter the circumstances of our birth. But some of the same people who say that also say there will always be poor people. Historian Nancy Eisenberg takes us on a journey for the truth in her book, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. Nancy Eisenberg is professor of American history at Louisiana State University, LSU. Her writing appears regularly in Salon.com. She and Andrew Burstein joined forces for the book Madison and Jefferson, and her solo book Fallen Founder about Aaron Burr received critical acclaim and award recognition. Nancy Eisenberg, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thanks for having me.
So this book is a bit of a departure from the biography track. What prompted you down this pursuit?
Well, you have to realize that my first book was also not a biography. I wrote about antebellum politics, the origins of the women's rights movement. But what drew me to write about this is I've always been interested in class. Writing about Aaron Burr, I talked about how he was attacked as an elitist. Writing about Jefferson, I became very deeply interested in his ideas of pedigree and breeding, which is sort of another important theme of my book. So it's not a complete departure to move in this direction. But I think that the other reason I wanted to write this book is because not only contemporary politics, but this long-standing theme, as you mentioned in your opening, that Americans imagine that at the time of the Revolution, we broke free from Great Britain and we escaped the legacy of a class society. And part of this, as I highlight, is the myths that we tell ourselves. And Americans like their myths. They become integrated with patriotism, public history, entertainment. But the truth tells a very different story. The truth tells a story about how Americans, even though we like to talk about all men are created equal, and we like to allude to equality in abstract terms, when it comes to actually recognizing people as equals, there we're not so good. Because essentially what I've tried to do in this book is uncover this evolving taxonomy of talking about poor whites. And each generation created its own language, its own slurs in which to dismiss the poor, beginning, as you mentioned, in the colonial period, where the indentured servants, the convicts, the refuse of British society were going to be dumped into the New World, and they were called waste people.
Or as you point out in some of the other chapter titles, which are quite provocative, Thomas Jefferson's Rubbish and Andrew Jackson's Cracker Country. I mean, this is very much a recurring theme in our history. Now, the economic elitism shouldn't really be surprising when you consider the political elitism. You look at the creations of things like the Electoral College indicated that the founders were not all about having just everybody have a say.
No, I think that's another one of these myths that we have. First of all, what they imagined is they were recreating a republic, and they viewed democracy in very hostile terms. They viewed democracy as something that would lead to chaos and disorder. And there was a very strong sense of distrusting the poor, the lower classes, or the common people, as they referred to. And this, again, is a British heritage. We have to realize that at the time of the founding, the people who were allowed to vote were property owners, male property owners. And that's another theme that I highlight in my book, is the importance that class has been rooted to land, notions of land. That idea of waste people comes from wasteland, land that is left unproductive and fallow. And we have to realize that for over half of our history, we were an agrarian nation. So understanding our rural roots, understanding how this language of class comes out of a rural tradition is something that I think we tend to have lost sight of. But it's extremely important, and in order to understand some of the problems that we have today with inequality, we can't just talk about the 1%, because they alone are not the problem. The problem is the ideology of class. And the middle class are often just as much engaged in reinforcing the boundary between the middle class and the lower class. And that's something else we have to address. The privileges that the middle class have had, privileges that we often sort of ignore or don't take into account when we talk about class, because class isn't just about income and occupation, it's about inheritance.
Well, the first sentence takes us to the book To Kill a Mockingbird, and you remind us how scathing Harper Lee was of the people she considered white trash.
Right. I mean, this is a I have been teaching this the film for over 15 years. And what I try to present to my students is this idea is not only does this expose the racism of the South, which we are familiar with, but also the incredible hostility in which elite whites viewed poor whites. And this is embodied in Mayella Yule, who and her father, whose name is Bob Yule, but as I highlight, his real name was Robert E. Lee Yule, but he's not an heir of one of the aristocratic families. And one of the points she makes is really very important. The novel and the film were set in the Great Depression, and what she argues is that the Great Depression, even though that led to 20% of our population out of work, she said that had nothing to do with the poverty of poor white trash. Nothing could change their status. And that's incredibly damning. That's basically saying that forget about charity. You can't help these people. There's no way that they can assimilate into normal society. And there's also a racial agenda in her critique. Not only does she say that no one knew how many children they had, so that's the idea that they're associated with indiscriminate breeding and inbreeding. They're associated with congenital defects, various worms, and hookworm is a really serious problem in rural America all the way into the 20th century because of the lack of proper sanitation. But she also makes the point that we have to remember that when she describes where these people live, she describes their home as a rundown shack that once was a Negro cabin. So the other point she's saying is that poor whites were even lower than blacks.
Wow. It's some fairly intense stuff as we get further into the book. It's called White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Historian Nancy Eisenberg is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk much more about this. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are having our eyes open today about our attitudes toward the people at the bottom of the economic ladder in America, the white people at the bottom of the economic ladder, as drawn by Nancy Eisenberg, the historian, in her book White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. You can join this discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Harper Lee in To Kill a Mockingbird, in describing the really poor, well, the white trash family, she describes them as, and as you just alluded, talk about them in terms of living in old Negro cabins, actually lower than black poor black people. So pull out to the rest of us, though, and why do you say that we all have sort of a narrow and skewed understanding of white trash?
Well, I think we tend to think of white trash as a terminology. When it was first used, that word white trash is first used in the 1820s. That's when it appears in newspaper print. But as I try to point out and argue and find extensive amount of historical documentation to back this up, it goes all the way back to British ideas, not only of the land, but British ideas for how do you get rid of the poor. And this is one of the things that we don't like to deal with. The assumption for the British, they didn't look at the New World as a city upon the hill, as some promise for religious freedom, or the idea that what we tell ourselves with the American dream, that we promise social mobility. They saw it as a dumping ground for the idle poor, the dregs of their society. And the people who migrated during the colonial period were the poor. You have convicts, you have whores, you have Irish rebels, you have indentured servants, which is a form of labor that we tend to forget about. Basically, poor whites of the British society would sign on to labor for 7 to 9 years, and often the group that they exploited the most in the colonial period were children, were young men. And the idea that somehow if they worked hard and got ahead that they would own land is just not true, because we forget that most of them would die because of the horrible conditions of what it actually meant to live in places like Virginia in the 1600s. Vast numbers of people died. And that also is another idea of waste. They thought it's better to, like, get rid of them rather than have them burden the English economy. So even if they died when they were sent overseas, most people in Great Britain didn't care.
The descriptions on the English side are, it's hard to describe them, but you describe people living in essentially caves, or at least that was the view of the upper classes, that you had these filthy creatures who were barely human living in subhuman conditions in parts of London even.
Yes. I mean, that's the other thing. This goes all the way back to the 1400s, that, you know, the English are the two groups that they, and the language that they used and the groups they attacked were the idle poor and vagrants, the mobile poor. And yes, vagrants, in a sense, were not, you know, were seen as people who were unattached to the labor system. They would move from place to place, and they actually weren't idle physically, because they often could migrate up to 20 to 60 miles in an entire month. But they were never incorporated into the labor market. They weren't dutiful servants. So that's why they were seen as a burden. And you're right, you get all these really negative connotations, as if they're living in these caves outside of London. The other term that is most disturbing that they used to describe the poor was offscourings, which refers to fecal waste. So when they meant waste, they meant the worst idea that you could possibly imagine. And they also compared them to diseases that needed to be drained, like the liver draining, filtering the blood system. So yes, the one thing about the Elizabethan period, nothing was hidden when they used these really, really blunt terms to talk about the poor and why they needed to be dumped somewhere else.
Historian Nancy Eisenberg is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is White Trash. But then how do you square this up? And you do really pull apart Thanksgiving. We'll get into that in a second. But how do you square the idea of dumping the poor whites across the Atlantic in America with the stories of the people who arrived at Plymouth and wanted to build this great new free religious society?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we have to realize is that the people who subscribed to the Puritan religion were a minority. They even were not the majority when we look at John Winthrop's Great Migration. That most of the people who were coming to America, some were coming because they wanted to get land. Even Winthrop argued that if you came here, somehow you'd be able to own more land. But they also came as families, and they came with servants, and they came with young boys. And that's the other thing we forget about the Puritans. Not only did they support slavery, and they supported capturing Native Americans and making them slaves, the group that they felt that was the most important to exploit were children. And this is another part of our history we tend to forget. We had child labor in this country. It was legal all the way up until 1919. So this is sort of another dynamic that reinforces the status of the poor. Your class status is measured by the status of your children. If you are poor, you have nothing to give to your children. There's no inheritance. And in fact, children who had no parents, orphans, could be sold into indentured servitude, or as I said, into the 20th century, they could be coerced to becoming apprentices, taken from their parents, and used as forced labor. So this is another part of our thinking of class we have to remember. Not only does the middle class and the elite class ensure that their children will be in a good position, and sociologists have found today that the best predictor for success in our society is the wealth and privilege that's not only passed from your parents, but your ancestors. But at the other end of the spectrum, when children are given nothing, they are vulnerable to exploitation, and they are also seen to justify the idea that the poor are exactly where they deserve to be, because their future and the way in which Americans would focus on the pedigree of families and the rise of the eugenics movement was focusing on the fact that class is reproduced from generation to generation. So children are really an important part of our past that goes all the way back to the colonial period that we tend to ignore and not talk about.
You've already alluded to the documentation that you pulled into to support your argument here, but you get into real specifics with the pilgrims and Thanksgiving, and I'll use quotes around both of those terms because, as you point out, a lot of this stuff came later.
Right. Right. That's the part of the myth-making, and this is one of the things that I think we know. Americans like myth much better than reality, and children in grade school are often told myths. Thanksgiving, in a sense, doesn't become a holiday until the Civil War, and one of the points that I highlight is the very famous account of Squanto, who helped the pilgrims survive that difficult first winter. The reason he knew English is because he had been captured and used as a slave. And that's part of the story that we don't tell our children. And in fact, a year after that famous winter, he's dead. And that's the sort of, we forget how harsh and terrible the conditions were at this time. And we also forget that using servants, an exploited population, was something that was widely accepted not only in Great Britain, but those same ideas became well ingrained in New England and even more in the southern states. And we have to realize that slavery built on the exploitation of indentured servitude. It reinforced all those ideas that you need a population that you can exploit in even worse conditions, if we think about disease, if we think about the climate in places like Virginia.
Historian Nancy Eisenberger is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of American history at Louisiana State University and the author of White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Watching the Beverly Hillbillies and Honey Boo Boo is the least of it for us. The fact is there's a lot more scorn heaped upon the bottom of the economic ladder on the white side for centuries now, as she points out. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your comments, questions, observations of your own are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The concept of getting the trash, or whatever the term was used in England at the time in the 1500s and 1600s, out of the country sounds very much like rounding up the homeless and sending them away.
Yes, I mean, it is exactly the same. I mean, if we think about how, and not only was it the English idea of dumping the poor into the colonies, our own frontiers, if we look at the early Republic, if we look at the old Northwest, the southern backcountry, if we look at how our frontier was first imagined, it was that idea of the safety valve. That also reinforced the idea of dumping the poor somewhere else. And the language that they used at that period was, and this is where we get into Andrew Jackson, was to refer to them as squatters and crackers. And the cracker is a word that people still use today. It's so interesting because, again, it's built on the idea of the vagrant poor. The word migrated. It's first identified in the mid-18th century in Virginia. It migrates down to North Carolina. It ends up in Georgia in 1790, and it's in Florida. Florida crackers well into the late 19th century. And who was a cracker? There was the term louse cracker, so it's a kind of, you know, filthy, louse-ridden fellow. The term that I think is so important about cracker is it comes from the idea of crack-brained, which meant idle-headed. So again, it reinforces the idea that these people aren't productive. They're idle in body and idle in mind.
You've talked extensively about the white indentured servitude. This becomes a story of two colors very quickly in Virginia. What did slavery do to the original plan, and why were slaves brought in if there was a fair amount of white people who could do some work?
Yeah, I mean, even at the time of Bacon's Rebellion, which happened at the end of the 1600s, the economy is still heavily dependent on tenant laborers and poor white labor. But you begin to see that transition for a variety of reasons. I mean, one of the things that I think is so important, and this is something that other scholars have alluded to, is that in 1662, a law is passed in Virginia that defines how is it you become a slave. It was no longer that you were heathen, and it wasn't about skin color. The law said you were a slave if your mother was a slave. And that the same way, the same law that came from England on bastardy, the bastard follows the condition of the mother. Those two arguments were used to reinforce the idea that slavery was passed through the mother's line, and to reinforce this idea of pedigree and breeding and a population you can exploit. And that's really important, because that's another theme I talk about, is this importance of how class is passed from generation to generation. And it was also instrumental in the way in which slavery would be defined and legally reinforced in Virginia from the time of the mid-1660s.
So let's get an idea of the view of the people who would be employing white trash, if they were considered employable. I mean, did they think of them as useful people to have around? Could you elevate yourself and become, well, he's okay, you know, he's a good worker, but he's still white trash? I mean, I'm trying to figure out where the sentiment fell.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it varies, you know, place to place, and we have to realize that word sometimes is used as a political attack, and it may include a larger group of people than if we just measured it in terms of their economic condition. But it gets really complicated. For example, in the antebellum period, you find that the way in which Southerners thought about their class system, and one of the people I highlight is an Alabaman, Daniel Hundley, who wrote a really book in 1860. He would soon be a Confederate. He argued that there were seven different classes in the South, and at the bottom, he argued there were two classes. One he called white bullies, and the other he called white trash. Now, the white bullies were the people who dreamed of owning a slave but never would, and they also were a group that might be hired to be overseers. But the white trash, the people on the bottom, they were seen as people who lived on the fringes of the plantation. And not only that, he reinforces this pre-eugenic idea, this idea that goes back to animal breeding, that the white trash, it wasn't the economic condition which created their poverty, or the fact that they couldn't own land because slave owners monopolized the land. It was because they had inherited their class status. Vagrancy in their class identity was now congenital. Basically, he argued you could trace their pedigree back to the indentured servants in Jamestown and back to the poor dregs who had lived in the back alleys of London. So this is another point I try to make. If you look, you can see that Americans had very sophisticated ways of talking about their class system. They didn't hide it. They didn't pretend like social mobility was available to all. And when you say class at the bottom is congenital, you're not saying that these people can ever really be incorporated into society. Now, real white trash people in the antebellum period might be hired as menial laborers. They might be hired as workers in cities like New Orleans and Baltimore. A lot of them left the Old South and moved west, but then again, they found they couldn't own land, so they would have to keep moving. Some of them worked as tenant workers, part-time laborers, and some of them would work side by side with slaves in the fields. So this is the other thing we have to recognize, that class identity was crucial for not only reinforcing the racial hierarchy, but also was intimately again tied to who had land, and the way in which each generation finds it so easy to dismiss the people at the bottom, to assume that they can never be normal, to assume that they don't even mind and actually would prefer that they would move west. And that's the other theme I highlight in this book, the whole myth that westward migration would lead to equal opportunity. This is something that Franklin emphasized. He claimed it would flatten out the class system and create a happy mediocrity. But it's not true, because the class system followed people as they moved west. The large land speculators, the large landowners, they had the inside track with the business office, the land office, which would sell the land. And on top of that, what you're getting, you're promising horizontal mobility, not upward mobility. And this is one of the things we've confused. We've confused the rhetoric of Franklin and Jefferson as promising upward mobility. But in fact, all it's promising is that you have the right to move. You have the right to migrate. If you make it, okay, that's fine. But if you don't, as Franklin said, in very cold terms, either you're going to die off or you're going to have to move on and find another piece of land and start over.
One of the things I noticed, particularly in the section with Benjamin Franklin, is that the overall dim view of the idle people, and yet Franklin managed to make enough money to become fairly idle himself.
Right, and I think that's really important. His views on idleness are just completely echoing what the British thought, dismissing the idle poor. And Franklin was not at all sympathetic to the poor. And this is another thing we tell ourselves. We assume, well, if you've not come from the elite class, and he didn't come from an elite class. He came from a very large family. He was apprenticed to his elder brother. He ran away from Boston. He was a runaway servant, which put him into that vagrant class. He ended up going to Philadelphia. But he also didn't make it on his own. This is the other myth we tell ourselves, the self-made man. He needed patrons. He needed people to help pave the way so that he could rise up and establish himself as a printer. He couldn't do it on his own. But he retained that very hostile attitude about the poor. He didn't like workhouses. He even attacked the British. He said the British indulged the poor by giving them charity, where the Germans, who gave the poor nothing, would create people who would work harder. So yes, that is exactly where, you know, Franklin's hostility to the poor.
Yeah, a lot of the old pull up by the bootstraps thinking here. We're talking to Nancy Eisenberg about her book, White Trash. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange to talk more with Nancy and to take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Nancy Eisenberg, historian, professor of American history at Louisiana State University, author of the book White Trash, the 400-year-old untold history of class in America. There has always been an underclass, and a lot of people think there always will be. We're talking about how long back this goes, and in fact, it is 400 years plus. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, with your questions, comments, observations. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Ben Franklin, the colonial period. I want to get into John Locke, who was certainly the darling of the Enlightenment and an inspiration for the Declaration of Independence. He had a dark side, too, though, in all this. What was that?
Again, John Locke is an Englishman. And part of the story that's never told about him, because people focus on his theories of the social contract and the way in which he attacked monarchy, he was a major contributor to the founding of Carolina. Before there was South Carolina and North Carolina, there was just Carolina. And his blueprint, if you actually look at what John Locke thought was the model for a colony, not only did he endorse slavery, and in no way did he back away from sort of assuming that slavery would be used, and he felt it was essential to the colony to exploit slaves. But he also created a very unusual class hierarchy, where he created and called for a group that would fall into the class of serfs, essentially a group of people who would be tied to the land. That means if children were born to parents who were working for a particular master or manor, Lord, that essentially they would need the permission of that master in order to be able to move. And he also thought about this, this is another thing that we tend to forget about, that he wanted to create a class barrier, that if you do create an elite class, and in this case it will be a slave-owning elite class, he also assumed that this serf class would serve as a barrier to protect the elites from possibly slave revolts, from the increasing number of people who were moving into the Carolinas, particularly what will become North Carolina, who were the landless poor. And the term that would often become popular in North Carolina in the 1700s and the 1800s was to refer to the poor as lazy lubbers. And in my book, I include a very old drawing of what lubbers looked like.
Yeah, the map of lubberland.
The map of lubberland, where essentially you see people just laying on the ground, incapable of moving. And this is another important theme where it gets us back to the land again, where they basically felt that if the land, in a sense, the quality of the land, the environment would create the kind of people who were there. And this was the danger. This is the danger that you, if you have a high number of the landless poor, they're just going to be a drain on society. And this is essentially what Lubberland was about, that these are idle poor, and this gets, the idleness is not only seen as being lazy or not working, but it also gets associated with resisting British rule. This is the story of Lazy Lawrence, which gets connected to the lazy lubbers, which essentially meant that Lazy Lawrence had the power to put the masters asleep, and that became a metaphor for resisting paying your taxes. And this was sort of another sign of, you know, the dangerous underclass, that they, in a sense, will lead to what they called social leveling, which what we today would call class revolution.
Let's take a call from Misha in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nancy Eisenberg.
It's an interesting discussion here. I was reading a book about, and there was saying that in Virginia, in that time there were some people that had so much land, like Washington, and some of the Washington knew that the guy was from England. He had land like hundreds of thousands of acres, big enough as like a state of like New Jersey or something, and then workers later, when they had the wages got lower and lower and lower, and people try to work. And nowadays, they say there is a book on multiculturalism that says the poor versus the middle class, to leave out the rich. But we started out with the rich, in Virginia, like with some of the people that had got these land grants and had so much, and the other people didn't have hardly anything.
Right, and land grants were just, you know, were handed out in a very unequal fashion. The other thing that's really disturbing is what historians have referred to as the headright system in Virginia. Essentially, if you came over to Virginia and you brought indentured servants, you were given even more land. So that means you're already going to be part of the elite class because you have been able to contract these servants, to work for you. But what I found really disturbing with the headright system, it didn't matter if the servants actually lived when you arrived. If they died on the trip over, you still got your land. So it didn't matter whether you were dead or alive, servants could be exploited. And the caller is exactly right about the concentration of wealth in Virginia. That's why at the time of the American Revolution, Thomas Jefferson is a large landowner, George Washington is a large landowner and also a land jobber in the frontier area, and part of the American Revolution, which I've written about in Madison and Jefferson, was about getting beyond the restrictions that the British had imposed on not allowing the colonists to expand westward and establish land companies, which were controlled by the elite. But here's a statistic for you. At the time of the American Revolution, 40% of Virginia's population, the white male population, didn't own land and didn't own slaves. By 1930, in the Depression, it's the same. 40% of the population are landless tenants. Two-thirds of that population are white. Two-thirds are in the South.
Hmm. We have two emails, actually, both asking about when we were talking about To Kill a Mockingbird and your study of the movie. They're asking about Go Set a Watchman. And Scott in Ashland points out that Scout seems to accept her family's judgment that even after a childhood friend of hers has completed law school and gone into practice with her father, he remains white trash, not her kind.
Right. Right. Now, and I think that's important because, again, we know that the more recently published novel is offering a much less rosier portrait, you know, because in To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch is very much portrayed as this enlightened, almost godlike, saint-like figure, and that isn't in the second story. But that theme, and I think this is part of the problem, is that the assumption is that, you know, poor white trash at this time in the 1960s are also being seen as the source of all racism in our country. Mm-hmm. And we know that that's not true. Racism takes different forms, but the reason that that became so prominent in the 1950s takes us back to Little Rock, Arkansas, which I highlight and influenced someone like Harper Lee. Because in Little Rock, it was, and this is in 1957, there was a struggle over desegregating Central High School. Governor Orville Faubus refused to comply with the courts. President Eisenhower sent in the troops to ensure integration. Even Eisenhower, when he spoke to the televised audience, he basically argued that this was only a minority of people, that the good people of Little Rock were willing to support the law and by implication were not racist. Faubus himself was attacked as hillbilly stock. And what is the most important, because this was the most important domestic news story of 1957, it was covered internationally, is it was the white demonstrators who captured the headlines. They were dismissed as rednecks. The women who were, the poor white women were called slattern housewives. And by
those are some scary pictures we should remind people of, that are people just screaming right. their heads off at black students.
Right, right. And that very famous picture of Elizabeth Eckford and Hazel Bryan, who most people did not know who she was, three different photographs were captured that had that exact same picture of the white girl who is portrayed as wearing her dress too tight, implying that she is, you know, sexually deviant. She's yelling. You have that angry face. And this is essentially what the Times Literary Supplement said. It said that what would be remembered from Little Rock were the ugly faces of rednecks, crackers, Tar Heels, and other poor white trash. And the thing we have to understand is that Governor Orville Faubus was willing to exploit white racism and was willing to exploit the tension between these two groups. Before school even opened, he said that there was going to be a race war. He said that poor whites were going to come from all over the state into Little Rock, Arkansas. And there also was a class and racial element to how desegregation was even imposed in Little Rock. There were three high schools. There was one, the elite white school called the Cadillac High School, which was not desegregated. And then there was an all-black school. And then there was the working class Central High School, which was the one chosen for desegregation. So these are the things that we need to understand. And what's so important about Little Rock and those ugly faces, here was the template for the insane bigotry of Bob Ewell. So Harper Lee, as the kind of worldly person she was, she also lived in New York, was really not only talking about poor whites and reflecting the kind of class prejudice that she grew up with, she's also tapping into the larger political environment and the way that was being captured at Little Rock in 1957.
We end up talking about a fair amount of fictional figures here, but it's really interesting to notice that within a couple of years of To Kill a Mockingbird, the movie, we had the Beverly Hillbillies and a continuum of country comedies that a lot of the country watched at that time until somebody at CBS said, this is gross, let's get it off. But this is a straight line up until today's There Goes Honey Boo Boo, and where we get to laugh at real people. But this has been a feature of American life for more than 200 years.
Yeah, we have kind of, there's sort of two strains. There's always an ugly side connected to most of these really negative, vicious portraits of poor whites. And that, we can say, with reality TV, taps into a voyeurism, the idea that people want to say, well, look at these horrible people, at least I'm not that bad, or to laugh at them. It's sort of the freak show. But the other side that you're alluding to, if we think about Duck Dynasty, fits more into the vaudeville tradition, a tradition which we can trace back to Hee Haw, and that even in the 1940s, before that, with someone like Minnie Pearl, who got her start in radio. Minnie Pearl was highly educated, came from a upper middle class family, but she played the role. And that's essentially what we also see in the Beverly Hillbillies. But what I highlight about the Beverly Hillbillies that we need to remember is at the very same time that show is being aired in the 1960s, there was a real issue. In the same way we know that there was a mass migration of African Americans up into northern cities, there also was a large influx of poor whites from Appalachia. And these were referred to as hillbilly ghettos. And they existed in Chicago, St. Louis, Cincinnati. And as one commentator, this is Paul Harvey writing for the Chicago Tribune, noted in one of his articles, he said, just imagine if you had the Beverly Hillbillies moving into your city in large numbers, but they didn't have all those bucks in the bank. So the Beverly Hillbillies, in the same way it was to laugh at the hillbillies and see as a contest between the snobs and the slobs, because the Beverly Hillbillies were always, the Clampets were always contending with Milton Drysdale, who was the elite banker. It also reflected this real issue of poor whites moving into cities, and in places like Chicago, the same kind of hostile slurs that were used against blacks in cities were used against poor whites. They were called sexually deviant. They were called lazy. They were seen as living in, as I said, in ghettos, hillbilly ghettos.
So, Nancy, we only have about a minute left. What hope do you have that that we can eliminate the underclass or elevate people, or is there always going to be a layer of people down there?
Well, I think it's really hard, but I think a start is for people to start acknowledging their own class privilege and to acknowledge that we do have a class system and the way it really operates. I know in the recent campaign, Bernie Sanders was talking about the 1%, but I think we have to move beyond just talking about the 1%. It's also about a class ideology. And I think if we're more knowledgeable of our class system in the past, and we can see that there are similar things we still do today, I think that's at least a start. From a historian's perspective, this is what historians want to do. History matters, and we have to understand the past to understand where we are today.
Indeed it does. The book is called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America, told at great length now by Nancy Eisenberg, historian at LSU. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care.